start with reciting na dhanam na janam na narim kavitam va jagadish kamaye mama janmani janmanishware bhavata bhakti raituki tvai. So here Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is actually rejecting everything material for the sake of ahetuki bhakti, the dhana jana sundari kavita. So these are all materially attractive things. So wealth, followers, the association of the opposite sex, and kavitam. Kavitam is sometimes referred to as learning. So the knowledge of being reputed as a very very learned person. All that I say no to that. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says, na dhanam, na janam, na sundarim, kavitam, va jagadish kamaye. What I want is life after life. Janmani janmanishware bhavatar bhaktir ahetuki toi. I simply want your bhakti. And when he is saying mama janmani janmanishware, that means he is also rejecting liberation. I don't want liberation. What I want simply is devotion. So I'll talk about the broad principles of this. In the Vedic path, there are these three broad categories of growing spiritually, we could say, or of living dharmically: karma, jnana, and bhakti. Karma is also a path of living dharmically, but it is a very gradual process where one is largely just trying to live in a live. Bhaktivinoda Thakur called them as pious materialists. Yeah. They're materialists, but they're pious. They're not impious or sinful. So the path of karma is there. Now, then the path of jnana is centered more on renunciation, rejection, and then the path of bhakti. So I'll try to analyze these three. So here is it. What the path of karma does is with respect to attitude towards the world. Karma romanticizes the world. Romanticize means, oh, this world is such, if you just adjust a few things, this will be so wonderful. So in that case, the path of karma kanda, the adjustment is basically we do some rituals by which we get bountiful harvest. We do some ritual by which we get children. We do some rituals by which we fulfill our desires. Or we do some rituals elaborate by which we go to heaven. And then life will become wonderful. So the idea is, this world is an enjoyable place. We just have to adjust the factors for enjoyment. That is broadly the path of karma. So karma romanticizes the world. And romanticize means, you know, think of it in a very poetic, a beautiful, very fanciful way, where we think there's a lot of enjoyment available over here. And then the path of jnana goes to the other extreme. And it demonizes the world. This world is full of temptation, full of danger, full of distress. Everywhere there is misery. So this an extremely negative view of the world, where everything in this world is seen simply as filled with temptation, filled with danger, filled with distress. And then there's the path of bhakti, which avoids both these extremes. If you consider a pendulum, one extreme of the pendulum is to romanticize, the other extreme is to demonize. The middle is to utilize. So utilizes. So whatever is there in this world, we utilize it for serving Krishna. So now, from this perspective, the first two lines of this verse are talking about this rejection of karma. Nadhanam, najanam, nasundarim, kavitam, va jagadish kame. None of the things of this world which people imagine will make their world a happy place. If I have wealth, if I have sense enjoyment, if I have fame, whatever, that will make me enjoy. He said, no, I don't want any of these things. That means he's rejecting the path of karma. And janmani janmani ishwari, I don't mind taking birth in this world again and again. I just want to be devoted to you. When there is a demonization of the world, the focus is on getting out of this world. The focus is not so much on, okay, after I get out of the world, where do I go after that? That is not the focus. Just get out of this world. That's why they don't focus so much on the other world, the higher reality. So the path of bhakti is that even if I am in this world, my dear Lord, bhavata bhaktir ahetuki tvai, I just want to develop unmotivated devotion to you. And so now if you look at the flow of the verses, the previous verse talked about it ended with kirtaniya sadahari. That when one has humility, tolerance, then by that we can constantly become absorbed in glorifying Krishna. And when we are absorbed in glorifying Krishna, then that higher taste enables us to say no to other things. Now, quite often, you know, we sometimes we say no externally to something and internally we are saying yes. Sometimes say in the morning we wake up, the alarm rings. You know, the alarm is ringing, it's telling us wake up, but inside there is a voice, go to sleep. So what happens is that there is that conditioning which is there, which speaks in a different way. So when we get the higher taste, we can say no, not just because we know that is the right thing to do, intellectually, but actually experientially, we know there's much better things to do in my life. So that experience comes when we have this kirtaniya sadahari. When we become absorbed in Krishna, we can say no to the worldly things. And it's interesting, if that verse is talking about kirtaniya sadahari, if one has already come to the level of kirtaniya sadahari, then why is he saying here that, my dear Lord, I aspire for pure devotion? He's saying that, ahetu kitvai. So, if we look at the Bhagavad Gita, it also says in 9.14, Satatam kirtayanto maam yatantascha drudamrataha namashyantascha maam bhaktya nitya yukta upasate. There also a similar theme comes. Here it is kirtaniya sadahari. There it is satatam kirtayanto maam. Same thing. Always glorifying me. And there Krishna uses the word yatantascha drudamrataha. They endeavor with great determination. So even those who are absorbed in glorifying Krishna, they also have to endeavor. So here the process is moving from sadhana bhakti towards the higher levels of devotion. So in the previous verse when it is said that in this way one can do kirtani sadhari, it's not saying that one has already attained that stage. See, in scripture there are some statements which are descriptive and some statements which are prescriptive. Descriptive means it's describing the situation over there. Or it is describing some things. And there are prescriptive. Prescriptive means this is what we should do. So for example, in the Bhagavad Gita, the 11th chapter that is there, it's mostly descriptive. Okay, Arjuna saw the Vishwarupa, says, Pashyami Vishveshwara Vishwarupa. He says, Aneka Bahu Darvaktanetram, Mahabaho Bahubahu Rupadam. I'm seeing many hands, many legs, many faces. So there is nothing in that which is an application for us. So in scripture, there are some sections which are descriptive and some sections which are prescriptive. Prescriptive is what we apply, but descriptive is what is more like information. Both are important, but from the practical point of view, the prescriptive is more important. So now, the previous verse, which is actually, it is Trunada Pisunija Tarvapi Sahishna Amarina Madalina Kirtaniya Sadahari. That when we do this, we will come to this level of Kirtaniya Sadahari. It is not saying that if we consider the flow of thought, it is not that already the person has come to the level of Kirtaniya Sadahari. Rather, by developing humility, by developing tolerance, one will come to the level of Kirtaniya Sadahari. And as if you remember the earlier flow that we talked about, it is the first five verses are talking more about the process of sadhana bhakti, Vaidhi sadhana bhakti, and then things will move onwards. So there it is a description of a process by which one can come to the level of Kirtaniya Sadahari, and that same process is continued to be described over here. So here, the focus is more in terms of what is one's desire. So what are the things one is saying no to? I'm saying nadhanam, najanam, nasundare, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is saying, and then he's saying, I want your bhakti, my Lord. So this is all a part of the process by which one can move forwards, and that level of kirtaniya sadahari, or the level of ahaituki bhakti, all that will be described in future verses. Because if we see, the next verse also is going to talk about, I am fallen in this material world. My dear Lord, please lift me up. So this is all a part of the process of sadhana bhakti, where one knows the process of how to move upwards. But one has not really gone there till now. One has known, okay, by developing humility, by developing tolerance, I'll come to the level of kirtaniya sadahari. By saying no to these things, then actually I'll be able to say the yes to these things also. Yes to, I'm saying no to these things, so that I can become absorbed in Krishna. So here, in terms of the analysis, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is rejecting the paths of karma and jnana. He's saying, I want to focus on the path of bhakti. Ahetukitvai. Now, actually, if we see, there is a significant difference of context between the Bhagavad Gita and the Bhagavatam. In the Bhagavad Gita, Nowhere does Krishna directly recommend renunciation in terms of renunciation of action. In fact, Krishna repeatedly disapproves renunciation. He says that, you know, actually you should do your duty, you should fight. In contrast, if you look at the Bhagavatam consistently talks about renunciation. It talks about the lives of kings, but then it talks about how they renounce the world, how they go to the forest. So both are talking about bhakti, but the context of these two books is very different. What do you mean? Context, if we see, the Bhagavad Gita is spoken to a warrior for whom it is very important that he do his dharma, do his duty for establishing dharma in this world. Whereas the Bhagavatam is spoken to someone who is about to die. And there the focus is on, okay, don't worry about this world. Just focus on Krishna. So the context shapes the content. The context doesn't determine the content. The content in both cases is bhakti. But the context shapes the content. To give a simple example, you know, if there's some young devotee who is somehow discouraged or depressed, then we tell him, oh, come on, you know, this young devotee who has a lot of energy, a lot of passion, the devotee can do a lot of things, and that devotee says, maybe I should just go to Vrindavan, I'll become a Babaji, I will chant 128 rounds every day. We tell him, that's not practical. You do services, you distribute books, there's so much things you can do. So on the other hand, if there is some devotee who has been diagnosed with terminal cancer and they have only maybe 1 month to live, at that time we'll tell them, don't worry about anything else, you know, everything else will be taken care of. So if somebody is about to die and they have 1 month, at that time you're not going to tell them, you know, go and distribute books, raise funds for the temple. No. In both cases, the essential message is absorb yourself in Krishna. But what will be practical at one level may not be practical at the other level. So the overall, if we see the focus of the Bhagavatam is on renunciation of the world. Renunciation of the world. But why is that? In bhakti, renunciation is also favorable for bhakti. In bhakti, engagement is also favorable. It can be favorable. But the point is to connect with Krishna. So if we, as I said earlier, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, among Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's followers also, there were renunciates and there were householders. And both of them were exalted devotees. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu himself was a renunciate. But at the same time, he was not in any time, any way, minimizing or downgrading the grahasthas. They were also very exalted devotees. So the mood of this verse is not so much of renouncing the world, but rather renouncing the obsession with the world and focusing on Krishna. So bhakti utilizes the world. Utilizes means whatever I have over here, I use it for service to Krishna. And that way we can move forwards. I'll talk about one more point, then we can move forward. Right? See, this is aversion to commitment is not detachment. And the process of bhakti is neither about attachment or detachment. It is about commitment. So, now, I'll explain both these points. There is renunciation and there is detachment and there is irresponsibility. So what is the difference between the two? What, there is detachment and there is irresponsibility. So how are the two different? So if you are talking about a student is studying. So, usually speaking, the detachment is after the duty is done. Irresponsibility is before doing the duty. That means if there is a student says, I'll not study for the exam only. That is not detachment. That is irresponsibility. Because studying is the duty over there. So, there is detachment, which is good, but irresponsibility is not at all good. You want to note this down, or should I repeat this? I'll come to that. So there is the point which I'm making over here is that there irresponsibility and detachment are not the same thing. Irresponsibility means where I don't want to do my work only because I am lazy, because I am because I don't value things, so I just neglect things. So irresponsibility and detachment are two different things. And especially in today's times, you know, we live in a culture which is quite averse to commitment, whether it is relationships, whether it is whatever it is. Especially now, people often, instead of even without marrying, they want to live together. They don't want to commit to a relationship. Why is that? Because what happens in commitment, they feel, okay, then I have to take up responsibility, I have to do this, I have to do that. They don't want to do that. So what happens when we live in a culture of aversion to commitment, and then we hear about detachment, we equate the two. Hey, I'm not making a commitment, I must be detached. But the different, but the two are very different things. See, what is the difference? When we are talking about detachment, that means the mind has various plans. When you do this, you will enjoy. You do this, you will enjoy. You do this, you will enjoy. Detachment means we have understood that all these mind's plans for enjoyment, they are not going to work. They actually don't give any enjoyment. So detachment comes when we reject the mind's various plans for enjoyment. Whereas when there is aversion to commitment, what happens is we still have a lot of faith in the mind's plans for enjoyment. But we are not sure which is the best plan. So what do we want to do? We want to stay open for all the options. Stay open for all the options. Okay, whichever option works, that's wonderful. So that aversion to commitment, it comes from, there is no detachment from the mind. There is no detachment from material things per se. There is just that I want to have all options for material enjoyment open. And then that way I can explore this also, I can explore this also, I can explore this also. And then there is actually a more degeneration into sensuality. There is no spiritual elevation. So Prabhupada says in one lecture that, you know, Krishna says, Sarvadharman Parityajya Mamekam Sharanam Raja. He says, Sarvadharman Parityajya, even the hippies had done that. They had given up their due to their family, to their nation, to their own career, to their parents. He said, I went and taught them Mamekam Sharanam Raja. So, Sarvadharman Parityajya is not all that difficult. Anybody can give up responsibility. But giving up responsibility is not the way to spiritual advancement. It is, we give up one responsibility to take up a higher responsibility. Maam ekam sharanam braja. He says, unless we do that Sarvadharman Parityajya will actually take one to tamoguna and cause degeneration. So only when there is maam ekam sharanam braja, there is elevation. So sometimes if there is too much focus on detachment, renunciation, rejection, then that can have an unhealthy effect. Because we talk about renunciation, rejection, but internally we don't have that realization. So then that leads to artificial renunciation where there is relapse into indulgence again and again. So bhakti, at least at the level of sadhana bhakti, it is primarily a process of commitment. Commitment means that I have commit myself to practicing bhakti. I commit myself to chanting. I commit myself to doing services. I commit myself to doing this. So if we are too attached or too detached, we cannot practice bhakti very nicely. Nati sakto nati nirvindo. In the 11th canto, in the Uddhava Gita, it is said, one should not be too attached nor too detached. And actually, nirvindo is not easily detached, it's more of averse. No, neither too attached nor too averse. Rather, there is a balance by which we move forward in our practice of bhakti. So the goal is ahetuki bhakti. The path is something which each of us has to decide. And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is giving us a very lofty level over here of, you know, I reject everything else for the sake of Krishna. Now, the important thing is for the sake of Krishna. So when we talk about material desires, now we cannot empty our heart of material desires. Because the heart has to be filled with something. So we cannot empty our heart of material desires, but we can crowd material desires out of the heart. Crowd material desires out of the heart means that when we develop spiritual desires, oh, I want to do this, I want to do this for Krishna, I want to do this for Krishna, I want to do this for Krishna. So when there are so many devotional desires in our heart, then the material desires get crowded out. But if I think, oh, I'm not going to do this, I'm not going to do this, I'm not going to do this, that no, it doesn't last for very long. Because in saying no, there is not much pleasure. And even if I say no, how long can I just keep saying no? I have to have something which I say yes to. And that is where commitment comes in. So the more we become committed to serving Krishna, the more we'll be able to better manage our material desires. Now, some material desires we just have to give up completely. Some desire, material desires we fulfill and then we realize their futility and then we put them aside. How to deal with our material desires? If we make that the primary focus, then we will get exhausted in that battle itself. So the focus is on serving Krishna, on committing ourselves to connect with Krishna. And when that connection with Krishna is there, from there, how I can manage the rest of my life, that will be revealed. So we focus primarily on trying to connect with Krishna. Now, two things with respect to this, that when we are trying to connect with Krishna, what we do is, firstly, we try to give our heart to Krishna. That's what we want to do in pure bhakti. But when we can't give our heart to Krishna, then we can give what is in our heart to Krishna. If I cannot give my heart to Krishna, then I can give what is in my heart to Krishna. What is in my heart means, we all have certain interests, certain talents, certain attachments, whatever it is. Now, we connect them with Krishna. See, I like to sing. So singing has a very prominent place in my heart. Then, I cannot think of Krishna constantly. But I like to sing, I'll sing for Krishna. Or for that matter, money has a prominent place in my heart. So then, if I give money to Krishna, then what happens by that? I'm giving a part of my heart to Krishna. And that way, I'm connecting with Krishna. So, the principle is, there has to be some kind of commitment. And that commitment is what leads to the elevation of consciousness. And in sadhana bhakti, the focus cannot be too much on rejection or renunciation. We have to renounce certain things. But if we focus too much on that, there is a atheistic joke about Christianity. They say, in the beginning was the word. And the word was no. So the Bible begins with, in the beginning was the word, and the word was God. So the atheists have removed God, and they say that in the beginning was the word, and the word was no. But their idea is Christianity saying, don't do this, don't do this, don't do this. It is just a no-saying religion. It always tells us no, no, no. So, but that is not the vision of bhakti. In bhakti, we have to say no to many things. But that is not our primary focus. Our primary focus is on finding Hare Krishna. Yeah. Our primary focus on finding how I can say yes to Krishna. And once that yes to Krishna fills my consciousness, then the no to other things will automatically happen. And that's why when we try to share Krishna bhakti with others also, if we focus too much on the rules, don't do this, don't do this, don't do this, then people get alienated. But if you can focus on giving them fulfilling means by which they connect with Krishna, then that connection with Krishna inspires them themselves to say no to other things and put other things away. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is saying, Nadhanam najanam nasundarim kavitnam va jagadishka. I'm saying no to all these things. But the focus is so that I can develop devotion to Krishna. Now, when we talk about the worldly things which we reject for the sake of Krishna, the rejection that we do, there is rejection that is done because of spiritual realization, and there is rejection which is done because of external regulation. Now, external regulation is also important. That means if I understand this is undesirable, this is sinful, this is immoral, I won't do this. That is important. And there are certain regulative principles which are important to follow. However, as we move forward in bhakti, the focus becomes not that these are sinful because of which I want to give this up. The focus is that I want to connect with Krishna and these things impede my connection with Krishna. And that's why I don't want to do these things. That's why I focus on connecting with Krishna. So when Srila Prabhupada, we see when he preached also, at least in the first time when he gave initiation, he told devotees they have to chant. And later on after initiation they came to know we have to follow these principles also. So what Prabhupada did not emphasize, you have to follow these principles. He focused on chant Hare Krishna, get the higher taste. And then by that the lower desires will go away. There is on the way to Krishna, you know, Prabhupada, you have such an inclusive vision. He says, if there is a person who is drinking and that person cannot give up drinking, then that person can think that the taste of alcohol is Krishna. Prabhupada adapts that rasoham of sukante and the taste of water. So Prabhupada says, he can think that the taste of alcohol is Krishna. And if he does that, then one day that person will become a great devotee of Krishna. So what does this mean? That means even when one is addicted to alcohol, at least think about Krishna. So Prabhupada is saying, think about Krishna. By thinking about Krishna, the connection with Krishna happens and then we move forwards. So when we are practicing bhakti, I'll conclude with one point and then we can have questions. See, we try to follow certain standards and then we struggle and quite often we may falter and fail in following the standards. And that can make us discouraged. So and sometimes we feel guilty, I'm not able to do this, I'm not able to do that. Now, see, this is the soul. This is the wrongdoing. And this is Krishna. This is soul, this is the wrongdoing, this is Krishna. Now, guilt should come here, between the soul and the wrongdoing. That means guilt is what stops me from doing the wrongdoing, or it makes me feel bad from within when I do wrong. So what is guilt? Actually, we consider our conscience. Now, conscience is like in some houses, there is a dog which barks when a thief comes. So our conscience is like, okay, I'll write this down, I think. Okay. Our conscience is like the dog that barks when the thief of guilt comes to steal our bhakti. Conscience is the dog that barks when the thief of guilt comes to steal our bhakti. And the bark of that dog, sorry, not thief of guilt, thief of sin. So conscience is the dog that barks. So when sin is coming and tempting us, come on, do this, enjoy this. So at that time, our conscience says, don't do this. So conscience is the watchdog that barks. So the thief of sin comes to steal our bhakti. And the bark of that dog is guilt. So in that sense, guilt is like an inner protection mechanism. Just like in our body also, you know, if say I'm sitting somewhere and I'm sitting on this chair and there's a nail in the chair, I feel a pain and immediately I jump up. So that is the body's defense mechanism, the reflex action, which keeps me away from any painful stimuli. So like that, there is a psychological defense mechanism which keeps us away from wrongdoing. So whenever we start doing some wrong, then the conscience becomes active and we start feeling guilty. I should not be doing this. And that protects us from wrongdoing. So in that sense, the feeling of guilt when we do wrong is good. But still, Maya can be very, very subtle. So what happens is, sometimes when we do something wrong and we feel guilty, so the guilt is meant to come between us and the wrongdoing. But sometimes that guilt comes between us and Krishna. That means, I start feeling, hey, I just can't follow the standard. So what is the point of practicing bhakti? Better let me give up the practice of bhakti. I am so pure. I am so impure. I am so fallen. And I will never be able to follow the standard. So let me just give this up. And then our inability to follow some standards, if that makes us discouraged, then that discouragement is coming between us and Krishna. And then that is actually unhealthy for our bhakti. So in one sense, anything that comes between us and Krishna, that is Maya. So if my discouragement, because of my being unable to follow standards, that is coming between me and Krishna, then even that discouragement can be Maya. So at one level, I may think, oh, I'm not able to follow standards, so I'm feeling bad. So that's a good feeling to feel bad. But if that is making me discouraged in the practice of bhakti, then there is no need to be discouraged. The discouragement is unfavorable. So if it is unfavorable, we have to avoid that. Now, what does it mean? It's not that any wrongdoing that we are doing, that's all fine. That's not the point. The point is how we respond to it. The only way we will be able to become purified is by practicing bhakti. If I become discouraged in the practice of bhakti, then there is no way I'm going to ever become purified. So, conscience is Vivek Buddhi, right? Conscience is Vivek. In Sanskrit, it's called Vivek. So now here, okay. Okay, wait a minute. I'll come to that. Just let me get to this one. So, we may not be able to avoid falling down, but we can avoid staying fallen. I'll explain what this means. That, see, in our practice of bhakti, there are, we all have certain desires, certain temptations. It may be lust, it may be anger, it may be greed, whatever it is. Now, these desires, they're all there and they trouble us. But they don't always trouble us with the same intensity. Now, if we consider electricity, like sometimes electricity, there are spikes. When the electricity, the voltage suddenly shoots up very high. So, like that, in the course of our life, sometimes we have spikes of desires. Normally, there is a certain level of agitation, but then suddenly, sometimes, the level of agitation goes very high. And during those spikes, we may just find it impossible to resist. We may indulge, we may fall, we may do something wrong also. But the point is, that spike doesn't stay always. Now, when I'm talking about this, I talk about guilt is here, when it comes between us and the wrongdoing. But this is, as I said, this is Maya. You could call this a pseudo-guilt. Now, pseudo-guilt means that which comes between us and Krishna, which discourages us in the practice of bhakti. So, what is this pseudo-guilt? So, there is a spike because of which I did something wrong. But then, afterwards, the pseudo-guilt makes me think, why should I practice bhakti? You know, I'll never be able to follow the standards. So, now the spike is no longer there. Now, I'm in normal consciousness. Now, I can practice bhakti. But I'm simply beating myself up. Why did I do that? I did wrong and I'm fallen and I'm like this and I'm like that. I'll never be able to practice bhakti. And then we stay fallen. So actually, the spike will come again in future. And maybe I may fall again at that time. But in between those falls, I have the opportunity to practice bhakti. But when this pseudo-guilt comes in, it does not allow me to practice bhakti in between the spikes. And thus, we stay fallen. So when the spike comes, then the desire may become so strong, it may just knock me down. So in that sense, we may not be able to avoid falling down. When the spike comes, it may just knock us down. But the spike came, okay, I did something wrong. But afterwards, the spike has gone. Then I need to rise and move onwards. But when the pseudo-guilt comes, you just think, oh, I'm good for nothing, I'm sinful, I'm fallen, I'll never be able to do it. And we stay fallen. So, but we can avoid staying fallen. That means once the spike has gone, we just rise and start practicing bhakti. And if we just start practicing bhakti wholeheartedly, gradually by the practice of bhakti, we will become stronger. And eventually when the spike comes, we will be able to resist it also. Otherwise, when the spike comes, we fall. And afterwards, we are discouraged, so we don't do anything. And next time the spike comes, We are unprepared to deal with the spike. And again we fall. Or we fall worse down. So it's like, what is happening in
both? The following characterization by Timothy O'Connor may be taken as canonical. The argument from consciousness 33, an emergent property of type.
Sorry. I think it acted like that. Yes, I'm lost. I'm limited time now.
Okay.
So,
yeah. When we fall for a particular desire, it's at that time the mind is tricking us. You know, come on, enjoy. You'll get a lot of pleasure. Come on, do this. And we fall for it. So, after that, at that time we are conscious of the mind and we succumb to the mind. But the mind is so cunning that first it becomes like a criminal who induces us to do crime. And then after that, that same mind becomes a judge and says, you fool, why did you do that? And the mind starts beating us. You know, you are so foolish, you are so sinful, you are so stupid. So many times you have done the same wrong thing. So what is happening? First the mind makes us do wrong and then the mind beats us for doing wrong. In both cases, actually I am simply conscious of the mind. I am conscious of the mind when it is saying when it tells us to do the wrong thing. And after that, I am conscious of the mind when I am thinking, I am so fallen, I am so fallen. In neither case, I am Krishna conscious. So sometimes the mind may just attack with so much force, we may not be able to resist. But after that, okay, I fell. Now let me rise. Let me practice bhakti. It doesn't matter, even if I did something wrong, it may be that in the future I may again do something wrong. But right now I can practice bhakti. And by the practice of bhakti, what will happen is, we will get the strength to move forwards. So this pseudo-guilt is, pseudo-guilt is what causes us to stay fallen rather than to rise. So when we are trying to practice bhakti, if we given to the pseudo-guilt, then we will never rise. But okay, even if I did something wrong, doesn't matter. Now let me rise and let me start practicing bhakti. Krishna is so kind that Krishna is still giving me an opportunity to practice bhakti. Krishna has not rejected me. Krishna has not, no matter what we do, no, Krishna is not going to leave my heart and go away and saying you are a hopeless person. No. Actually, there is nothing that we can ever do that can make Krishna stop loving us. We don't have that power to do anything by which Krishna will stop loving us. Krishna's love for us is not based on who we are. Krishna's love for us is based on who He is. Now, He is Surudam Sarva Bhutanam. He is the well-wisher of all living beings. He loves everyone. Normally we talk about Krishna as Bhakta Vatsala. In the 7th canto, 9th chapter, Prahlad Maharaj says, he refers to the Lord as Krupana Vatsala. Not just Bhakta Vatsala, Krupana Vatsala. I mean, those who are attached, He is merciful even to them. So Krishna's love for us is not based on who we are. Even if I am sinful, even if I am fallen, still Krishna loves me because He is God. He is the well-wisher of everyone. And Krishna's love means He still gives me the opportunity to practice bhakti. Even if I am not able to follow any particular standard, the important thing is I keep practicing bhakti. So there may be these lapses, there may be their falls, but in between those spikes when I fall, what do I do? If I keep practicing bhakti, eventually I'll be able to come to the level where I'll be able to resist the spikes also. So rather than worrying too much about times when the desires will become too strong and I'll not be able to resist it, we focus on right now, let me practice bhakti. And when those desires become too high, we'll see how to deal with them. Even if we fall, again we can rise and we can keep moving forwards. And so now in this case, what is happening is that if our conception of devotion is too renunciation centered, that means only if I give this up, then I am a serious devotee. If our conception of devotion is very renunciation centered, then renunciation doesn't necessarily mean renounced order. It can be renunciation of any particular pleasure. If our conception of devotion is very renunciation centered, then our inability to renounce that particular thing, that discourages us so much that we stop practicing bhakti itself. Or we become disheartened, half-hearted in the practice of bhakti. But if our conception of bhakti is Krishna-centered, it means, okay, this is a particular thing which I have to follow, but I am not able to follow it. Fine. I'll deal with it, but I'll continue practicing bhakti no matter what happens. Then that practice of bhakti will give us the strength by which we'll rise upwards. And eventually, we will come to the level where we will be able to follow the whatever standards we are expected to follow or we want to follow. So we shouldn't let the pursuit of standards discourage us. The standards are there so that we can rise upwards. But our inability to rise upwards, if it discourages us, then the discouragement is Maya. And then we say, no, I'll not get discouraged. I will. It doesn't matter, even if I'm not able to follow standards, I'll keep practicing bhakti. And by the practice of bhakti, eventually, whatever purification happens, that will enable me to follow the standards. So, renunciation, we should not make renunciation as the precondition for devotion. Renunciation is actually the fruit that will come naturally from devotion. So even if I am not able to renounce any particular thing, still I keep practicing bhakti. And by the practice of bhakti, eventually the renunciation and the practice of bhakti of particular standards, that will gradually emerge. So I'll summarize, then we can have questions for a few minutes. I started by talking about, in this verse, Adhanam Najanam Sundarim, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is rejecting the fruits of the path of karma and the fruits of the path of jnana, and he's focusing on wholehearted bhakti. So karma romanticizes the world. There are so many wonderful things. If I just get them, I'll become happy. Jnana demonizes the world. But bhakti demonizes means, oh, this world is filled with distress, temptation, danger. Just get out of here. But bhakti's focus is, utilize the world. Whatever is in this world, we can use it in Krishna's service. So, if we look at the context of the Bhagavad Gita, describes a version of, because of its context, the Bhagavad Gita's vision of bhakti is more centered on karma. Arjuna has to do his duty. The Bhagavatam's vision of bhakti is more related with jnana, in the sense that it is pure bhakti, but it is more focused on, Parikshit Maharaj has to renounce the world, focus only on Krishna. So the focus is on renunciation. The essence of bhakti is neither action nor renunciation. It is actually, it is devotion to Krishna. But the devotion can be done through action, it can be done through renunciation also. So, if we, because we live in a culture where there is, people are often averse to commitment, we may mistake that my aversion to commitment is detachment. But aversion to commitment comes from tamoguna, it is often irresponsibility. Whereas detachment means, I give up, I am a responsible person, but I give up one responsibility to take up a higher responsibility. I give up the mind's promises for pleasure so that I can focus on Krishna's promise and I devote myself to serving Krishna. So attachment and detachment, attachment is largely associated with the path of karma. Detachment is largely associated with the path of jnana. Bhakti goes beyond attachment and detachment to commitment. Actually, in pure bhakti, there is attachment to Krishna. That is spiritual attachment. But that we are far away from that right now. So at our stage, it is commitment. By the process of commitment, we will move forward and eventually develop pure devotion. We'll get attachment to Krishna. And in connection with commitment, I discuss this point elaborately about we commit not so much to following particular standards of renunciation or as so much as we commit to practicing bhakti no matter what happens. So in that connection, I talked about how a conscience is the dog that barks when this thief of sin comes to steal our bhakti. And the bark of that dog is guilt. So guilt should come between us and wrongdoing. But there can be pseudo-guilt which comes between us and Krishna. That means when I do something wrong, I feel so discouraged because of that, that I just give up the practice of bhakti. Then that is Maya and that has to be avoided. So in that connection, I discuss how the mind first makes us do wrong and then the mind beats us up for doing wrong. So when the spikes come, we may not be able to resist, but we don't have to keep lamenting that I couldn't resist at that time. In between the spikes, we keep practicing bhakti. So we may fall down, we may not be able to avoid falling down, but we can avoid staying fallen. That means once the spike has gone, what do I do after that? After that, I rise and start practicing bhakti with determination. And by that practice of bhakti, eventually we will become strong enough to resist the spikes also. And then we will rise to higher standards of purity and renunciation in our devotion. So any questions, comments? Yes, please.
Can you describe the kind of the proper spark of guilt. I understand how it shouldn't come between us and Krishna, but how should it manifest in such a way that it's actually
favorable?
I mean, the emotion or the thought process is
okay. So how can guilt manifest in a way that is favorable for the practice of bhakti? That is very nicely seen in the sixth canto. Ajamil, after he is saved by the Yamadutas, saved from the Yamadutas by the Vishnudutas. So it's significant that when the Yamadutas, they give a list of Ajamil's sins. And then Ajamil himself lists his sins. And actually Ajamil's list is longer than the Yamadutas' list. Ajamil says that, I left my father was old and my parents were old and I left them and they had to suffer because of that. There are several things which he says that the Yamadutas also don't talk about. That means he's very much aware of the wrongs that he has done. So it's not that in order to not feel bad because of guilt, we somehow deny whatever wrong we have done. It's not that we rationalize. But it's Ajamil fully accepts the confidence and accepts the wrong that he has done. But his focus is on somehow by Krishna's mercy, somehow by Lord Vishnu's mercy, he sent his Vishnudutas and saved me. Now I will determinedly practice bhakti. So that means what happens is, the right feeling of guilt is that first I am focused on Krishna and I want to connect with Krishna. And while connecting with Krishna, if I remember, I had done so many wrong things, I'm so fallen, I'm actually not qualified to have this opportunity. But I have this opportunity. Let me treasure this opportunity. So the feeling of guilt, when it makes us appreciate the opportunity to practice bhakti in spite of our disqualifications, then the focus becomes more on treasuring bhakti. So we are aware of our sinfulness so that we recognize that how unqualified I am for bhakti. And yet Krishna has given me this opportunity. So let me take this opportunity. And let me never again lose this opportunity. Let me never do anything that will even create the danger of losing this opportunity. So in that sense, the guilt is... So guilt in the light of Krishna consciousness. Krishna consciousness means I am conscious of how much Krishna has been kind to me. How Krishna has given me something. And in that light, how could I have done such a thing? How could I have done such a thing? It is so terrible. I'll never again do such a thing. So... without Krishna consciousness, many psychologists talk about how guilt is psychologically damaging. You have too much guilt, then you cannot do anything. And it is not only guilt that is psychologically damaging. Actually, there are so many material emotions that can be psychologically damaging. So what we need to have is we focus on Krishna first. And then awareness of our sinfulness and our disqualification for Krishna bhakti, and still Krishna's mercy in giving us bhakti, that is what is the primary characteristic of guilt as we see in Ajamil's pastime. So when guilt makes us aware of our sinfulness and our disqualifications, and therefore we recognize how merciful Krishna is to give me this opportunity, and we hold on to that opportunity, and that is guilt that is anukul to bhakti. Does that address the question? Or you have something more to add?
This is related. There's one quote from Bhajan Rahasya, Bhaktivinoda Thakur's commentary on Harinam Chintamani, where he describes that one who fails to try and free himself from anarthas, excuse me, in this lifetime meets only with misfortune. And then the next verse, and this is chapter 2, 42 and then 43, he says that on one's own, one can't free himself from anarthas, but if he cries to the holy name, several days, then the holy name will remove all the anarthas from his heart. So there's like this kind of like a recognition, I did something wrong, or I've got this issue, I've become contaminated with these material desires. But then he takes shelter of Krishna to free himself from it. It's kind of like the connects with deviation, Bunamayi, Mamamaya, Dharatya. You can't do it on your own. This is a powerful energy. So it seems like that's an important element.
Yeah.
The guilt. And you more or less said that.
Okay.
It should be impetus to just go further. But that kind of understanding is that actually, this is how I do it. This is actually how I get free of this incarceration of many desires.
Okay, yeah, I think this is a, yeah, so, how can we actually understand this feeling of guilt, as you said rightly, that I'm very sinful and then without Krishna's mercy, I cannot give up this sin. I can give an example here. Let's say if there is a beggar. The beggar is in a very poverty-stricken condition. And then somebody comes and gives a precious jewel. It will solve all the problems of money of that person. And then that beggar loses the jewel. And then afterwards, the beggar gets the jewel back again. Or beggar is given another jewel. And at one level, for the beggar to be aware of how poverty-stricken I am, that is important so that the beggar recognizes how precious the jewel is. So, similarly, if I am aware of how sinful I am, by which I become aware of how precious this opportunity to practice bhakti is for me, then that is favorable for me. If I think, oh, everything, I can practice bhakti anytime. I will enjoy now, afterwards I can come and practice bhakti. Having that casual attitude, then I'm not really aware of the power of the conditionings, the power of Maya, and then that guilt is not really working. It's basically like a lackadaisical attitude. I can enjoy now, I can practice bhakti later. So when the guilt is active, that means we are aware that I'm in such a spiritually poverty-stricken condition that without Krishna's mercy, I'll just sink down terribly. So when I'm aware that how say degraded the world around is, how degraded my mind is, and how much it can drag me down, then that awareness creates a sense of caution, a sense of healthy fear, we could say, and it keeps us from going in that direction. So if we understand the spiritually poverty-stricken condition of as in Kali Yuga, and we understand how precious is the wealth of bhakti that we have got, then that guilt, that awareness of our fallen condition can impel us to move towards Krishna. So beggar metaphor might help in appreciating the role of guilt. Thank you. Yes, Prabhu.
You talked about attachment, detachment and commitment. In describing it here, it appears to be very clear, but sometimes in the practical world, like Maya is so strong that sometimes we kind of miss the difference between whether it's attachment or detachment or commitment. In a practical way, it happens. So how can we stay strong to always recognize those differences, whether this is attachment, is it detachment, or is it commitment to bhakti?
Yeah, in a practical sense, how do we differentiate between attachment, detachment, commitment? See, broadly, there are areas we know that this is where I'm attached to. We all know our attachments. And if we observe ourselves, we also come to know about our aversions. You may be averse to some people, some situations, some places. We have our aversions. So if we observe ourselves, we can come to know about our attachments and our aversions in broad contours. And similarly, we can also find out what is it in bhakti that I am attracted to, that I can connect with strongly. And we try to develop some commitment for that. So now, once we have these broad contours clear, then in the specifics, we may not always be right. That means sometimes we may veer towards detachment, where instead of we may just be acting too much out of aversion, or sometimes we may be acting too much out of attachment. That will be, we will learn by experience. But broadly speaking, if we have an overall understanding of these are the things which help me to move towards Krishna, and I'll keep doing these things. Sometimes I may just veer too much in this direction. Sometimes I may veer too much in this direction. That is okay. They say that when, a plane is moving from, I came from Mumbai to Orlando. So when the plane is moving, it is not that the plane goes in a straight line. No, they say that almost for 95% of the plane time of the flight, the plane is off track. Because there is wind pressure, atmospheric conditions and all that, the plane just keeps going off track. But then the pilot keeps getting it on track back. So because the pilot keeps getting the plane back on track, that's how the plane eventually reaches the destination.
So like that, because we have this, we have some attachments, we have some aversions. So they may make us go off course sometimes. But if we are, we have an overall understanding of where we want to go, then we will ourselves understand, okay, this now I have gone off track, I have to come back in. So generally, if we are in the association of devotees, then, and if we have some good devotee friends, they may tell us that, okay, now we are going off in this direction. Or if we also have an introspective nature, then periodically, maybe once in 15 days, once a month, just look back and see, okay, how is my life going? Then, okay, this is, and I got too much into this. Or basically, quite often, when we start going in excess in any direction, the result is there is dissatisfaction, there is frustration, there is resentment, there is stress. Negativity starts coming up too much when our connection with Krishna becomes weakened. So when we start sensing that, see, the problem is, this is I'll conclude with this point, we can continue tomorrow. See, when material desires come up, we often think that, oh, now I have to indulge. Or we think, oh, why are these material desires come up? But the material desires may not necessarily be indications that I have to indulge in some wrong way. They may just be indications that my connection with Krishna has weakened. So whenever we start feeling our anarthas rising during the practice of bhakti, that can also be an indication that I'm doing something wrong over here. So then I do course correction and I come back. So if we are introspective, if we broadly understand our attachments, our aversions and our commitments, and we are introspective so that periodically we check out, then we can always do course correction and come back on the right track. So if you have any more questions, we'll continue tomorrow. Thank you very much. Shri Chait Gauranga Mahaprabhu ki. Shikshashakam ki.